delivered.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the House Transportation Economic Development Committee. It's Friday. We have a few people who want to get home, so we'll do our best to accommodate. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2310. And I should say before we get a summary from Troy that I view this as the opening conversation with respect to Connect Oregon. And I'll have a little more to say about that in a minute. Troy, could you give us a summary, please?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2310 relating to financing transportation projects promotes state's economic development, broadens Connect Oregon focus on non-highway transportation to include bicycle and pedestrian projects, authorize issuance of $100 million in lottery bonds for transportation projects funded from multimodal transportation funds, specifies use of lottery bond proceeds, creates five county regions for fund allocation of at least 10% of net proceeds, declares emergency effective July 1st, 2013.
Thank you. So a few thoughts on how we might handle it today. There are a number of people who have signed up to testify. I expect about their experience with the existing program, which I think is great. I think we'll maybe hear from them. And the bill, as you'll notice if you look at it, is a simple sort of extension of the existing program. If we decide to send it forward, it would go to Ways and Means. The bill as it currently exists has $100 million in it, as you'll see. The governor's budget has $60 million for Connect Oregon. So whatever we decide to do, we'll send it to Ways and Means where that number can be adjusted according to the other budget considerations. What I'm particularly interested in the conversation today and all of your thoughts in is any changes we should make in the process by which applicants are evaluated and in the policy angle of things. If it goes forward, this is the fifth round of Connect Oregon, so I think it's appropriate for us to think about whether that's working well or as we would like. So hopefully that is useful as you hear the testimony, and to those who would testify, I at least am very interested in what changes you think ought to happen, if any. So with that, we have David K-O-C-H, I'll take the risk, is it Koch? Great, Rob Didilius and Susie Lassane. Three names I may not have gotten right. And we're fine with you going in whatever order you'd like. Just please begin by introducing yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is David Koch. I'm the Chief Executive Officer. You were close. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay down on Southern Oregon's coast. We are the recent owner of the 135-mile Coos Bay Rail Link, which connects three counties in southwest Oregon to the Class 1 rail system in Eugene. Rail line begins in Eugene. Our ownership actually begins within the city limits and extends all the way down to the county seat in Coos County, which is in Coquille. We are a member of the Oregon Rail Users League, ORUL, and we're here today on behalf of the port and ORUL to support House Bill 2310 and the $100 million proposed for Connect Oregon, the Connect Oregon Multimodal Funding Program. And we're supportive of the program primarily because of how critical it is to Oregon's economy that businesses have competitive transportation options. And down the South Coast, we've seen firsthand what happens when you lose one of those transportation options or have the threat of losing it. And you know, the story on the South Coast began for us with the port in 2007 when the rail line shut down on 24 hours notice. The state was a critical partner for us in acquiring that rail line, going through a legal process to force the sale of the line to the port, not just for the benefit of the Coos Bay Harbor, but frankly for the benefit of nearly a dozen industrial users of the rail line spread among all three counties. We received $7.8 million from the state of Oregon under Connect Oregon 3 as a part of our effort to rehabilitate the rail line. All told, it's been a $46.5 million effort so far want to buy the line and then undertake the rehabilitation effort that's required when 134 miles of rail, 9 tunnels, and 115 bridges are neglected for as long as that rail line's infrastructure was neglected. We have been targeting the Connect Oregon money that we received under Connect Oregon 3 towards bridge rehabilitation, getting after the deferred maintenance on those 115 bridges. Three of those bridges are very large steel swing span bridges that cross the Siuslaw River in Lane County, the Umpqua River in Douglas County, and Coos Bay down in Coos County. They provide really the critical link for what's left really of the large industrial employers on the South Coast and in Southwest Oregon to be able to get their goods to market, as well as to be able to get raw materials in for what they manufacture. I want to provide one example of the statewide importance of maintaining those rail options even in rural parts of Oregon and maintaining rail as a transportation option, and that's the American Bridge facility in Douglas County. American Bridge has a manufacturing facility there, the only one west of Pennsylvania. They made the investment in 2003 in Douglas County because of the access to rail. When the rail line shut down, they laid off 90 of their 100 employees because they could no longer competitively bid on projects. Since we reopened the rail line for them in 2011 with the help of the Connect Oregon money and the other funding sources we received, they've been able to hire back 50 of the 90 employees that they laid off. They were able to competitively bid on a TriMet bridge project in Milwaukee, Oregon. And it's an example of how everybody wins. TriMet got it. The cheaper subcontractor bidding on that than they would have gotten otherwise. They saved money, and we put those people back to work in Oregon making those bridge components. We think Connect Oregon is a unique program. We think the rigorous vetting criteria that are in place and the vetting process that's in place ensures that we're making the proper investments in transportation infrastructure in this state, and we hope that the state continues its commitment to the program. And I appreciate the opportunity to come and testify today.
Thank you very much, sir. I'm not going to try your name again. You have to help us.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Rob Dedelius, and I'm from Lake Railway down in Lake County, Oregon. We're the contract operator of this county-owned railroad. And I'm here today in support of HB 2310. We've been a Connect Oregon recipient in prior years, and we've used this money to repair dilapidated parts of our line that was originally built in the 1930s, and also to upgrade our line to prepare for the larger and heavier rail cars that are used by the modern rail industry. As you know, Lakeview is located, and Lake County is a kind of a geographically isolated part of the state. So our two main customers, a mill and a perlite mine, really rely on rail transportation to get their products to market. Without rail, they'd be out of business, frankly. Both of these customers are growing, and which is kind of unique for, you know, extremely rural parts of the state. We really have a viable economy down there because of rail, and Connect Oregon has, I would say, has made that possible. You know, besides the immediate effects of Connect Oregon in Lake County, you know, the hiring that's happening there, I think it also benefits the entire state. The products that come out of our customers there in Lake County, they travel over other railroads on their way to the ports and industrial facilities in the Willamette Valley. Furthermore, as we do these relatively good-sized construction projects, a mile of railroad line, that's a lot of steel and other railroad parts. All of that is purchased from facilities in the Willamette Valley and the Portland area. So I really think that it's a boon to the entire state. Besides the direct, immediate economic benefit of the Connect Oregon program, I think that having a railroad in place is very important for any future economic development that would happen, such as the every other year mineral audits that the state is considering doing. Whatever's found there, it's really going to take a railroad in place to make that kind of development possible. So I think it really ensures our future to keep that viable transportation system operating and healthy. Thank you very much for hearing my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Delius. Let's hear from Ms. Lassane, and then we'll take questions for the whole panel.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Susie Lassen. I am Transportation Land Use Policy Manager for the Port of Portland and also Chair of the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee. The Oregon Freight Advisory Committee has been involved with the Connect Oregon program since its inception, and we truly believe that it's a model program. Oregon ranks ninth as the most trade-dependent state in the United States, with the Portland region being the second fastest-growing export region, exporting about a fifth of its gross regional product. And for Oregon businesses to grow, they have to reach these domestic and international markets, and they have to reach them cost-effectively. They rely on multiple modes. I think that's really the good news. We have a diverse group of industries here in this state that we are very proud of, and having all of the modes function and perform well for them is really critical. Making sure those connections are in place is also equally critical. Connect Oregon has provided the incentive for investments to the non-highway portion of the system, and the impact has been that for every dollar invested, it returns about 2.5 additional investments to the system, and that doesn't even account for the multiplier effect of business expansion that's resulted from the Connect Oregon investments. I would make one suggestion that we think about grade separations being a part of the program in the future. I think that's something that, as you look statewide, there's nearly 3,900 at-grade crossings in the state, with about a fourth of them in the Portland region, and they really do impede the flow of freight traffic, so I think that's something to consider in the future. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Other questions?
Clarifying question. I didn't. So grade separations are not allowed in Connect Oregon in the way it is designed at this point? I didn't know that.
Chair Reed, Representative McEwen, yes, that is correct. They are not allowed because there is a road component, so because they are eligible for road funding, they're not allowed.
Okay, thank you.
In fact, Representative McEwen, you've created a very nice segue. There's always kind of a challenge about whether we start with the theory or the specific examples, and I thought maybe we'd start with specific examples and then invite ODOT to give us a little more of the background and history, and we can ask technical questions of ODOT as well. Are there any other questions for this panel? If not, thank you very much for your testimony and for coming. Jerry, would you like to help us out with a little more of the background and how the program works, and then we'll go back to more examples and ideas of how things might need to change?
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, committee members. For the record, my name is Jerry Bohard. I'm the Transportation Development Division Administrator for ODOT. So provide some brief history of the program, and then I'll be glad to answer any questions. And I think, as you've all heard, that House Bill 2310 really continues the investment in multimodal transportation. And this really began in 2005 with the legislature, identifying approved $100 million of state lottery-backed funds. They did it again in 2007 and 2009. And the last legislative session was $40 million, so for a total of $340 million that has gone into the four Connect Oregon programs. And it is for the modes of marine, transit, rail, and aviation. So it is for those four modes, and it is for projects that are not highway eligible. So that was a real clear distinction that was put into the legislation. Clearly the need is there. Of the four programs that we've had, we were able to fund 203 projects with 424 projects requested. And of the $340 million, there was actually a request that totaled over $790 million. And I think, as you heard Susie Lassen talk about, that really we've seen, of the $340 million of lottery funds, we've seen at least $500 million of both public and private investment on top of the lottery funds. From a status standpoint, we've completed 83% of the Connect 1, 2, and 3 projects. So there's a few more that are going on. The 38 projects that were selected at Connect Oregon 4, actually two have been completed and the rest are in design and construction. And it's just been a little over a year, actually last August, when the commission approved that project list. From a process standpoint, all of these Connect programs have pretty much followed the same process. We've worked with five modal committees. Four modal committees that have reviewed the projects in our freight advisory committee. And then we have had each of our area commissions and our from a regional standpoint review the project. So you've had both a modal expertise as well as a regional expertise looking at that. And then coming together in what we call our final review committee and essentially taking two members from each of those committees. And they bring forward the prioritized list to the commission for their approval. I think the question was asked about any suggested changes. Senate Bill 260 actually identified two changes that we think are important. One was regards to geographic regions. We've made some changes within our ODOT geographic regions and like to see the geographic regions for Connect mirror those, and so it would be moving Columbia County. And then that way the whole structure of our stakeholders is consistent the way we do our other transportation selection process. And then also just because of the aviation projects, allowing for some finances relative to moving money over to the Department of Aviation for aviation projects. Would remind you that pursuant to the budget note, Senate Bill 5701, we did a report to the legislature about the Connect Oregon program, and because one of the questions that was raised was, what were the public benefits derived from these projects. And when we did the survey, we really broke it down into four areas: reduces transportation costs, improves access, and provides economic benefits, and provides critical transportation linkages. And so this report really highlights those projects. And also at the back of it really kind of summarizes how the breakdown has occurred financially from our modes and across regions. And for the most part, we have seen kind of a consistency in that breakdown from each of the Connect 3 programs. So Connect 4 programs, excuse me. So with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions, Chair.
Thank you. Questions? I can get us started. I wonder if you could identify any particular trends amongst the modes over the first 3 to 4 versions, if there are becoming more or less needs amongst them, and if you think clearly there are other non-highway modes that are not amongst the four you mentioned, how those relate as well.
Chair Reed, so I'm not sure, just thinking about the 200 some odd projects that were not selected, what the breakdown was. But I can tell you of the total funds that were awarded for the Connect 1 through 4, 44% went to rail, 25% went to aviation, 16% went to marine, 11% went to transit. And we had a few, 3% that was multimodal, which was identifying across modes. And that was, I think, pretty constant from each of our Connect programs. And probably from a regional standpoint, you really saw the bulk of the funds going to what we call Region 1, the Portland area, 37%. Region 2, which is the Salem area, at 22%, Southern Oregon at 13%, Region 4, which is our Central Oregon, at 13%, and then Region 5, which is kind of the La Grande, Eastern Oregon. So those are kind of the numbers I think for the most part have been consistent. What I couldn't tell you, I could go back and look, is, you know, the projects that weren't there.
And just to interrupt, if I understood you correctly, those are clearly the numbers on the ones that were awarded, and you're saying you don't have a sense of the...
Not off the top. I would be glad to go back and get that information
for
you.
That would be interesting.
Okay.
I appreciate that.
I'd be glad to do that.
Okay.
We tend to concentrate on what we've done versus...
Right.
Your other question with regards to the other modes, I think the one mode, obviously, that hasn't been part of this conversation has been the bike ped. But we do have, there is a program, 1% that went to bicycle pedestrian projects. And there's also within the federal program what we call transportation enhancements, which under MAP 21, the name has changed a little bit. So there were other funding opportunities for transportation or bike ped projects. Now, that's not to say that the need isn't as great. Typically, those programs also see kind of that 2-to-1. For every dollar that we have, there's $2 worth of requests. So certainly the need for that mode is there as well.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Lively.
So I have a couple of questions regarding. So this talks about 424 projects, of which 203 were funded. And so the question I'm asking about, so those other projects, so this is renewed every 2 years and it goes through. Do the other projects just stay on the list, or do people have to go back through an application process? And I'd also be interested to know, so based on that, people have identified those projects, so how many of those proceed on their own versus that they just wait to get back onto the list? Because otherwise, it appears to me the list is just going to keep growing if we don't look at what the options are from the standpoint of leveraging funds. So I'm just trying to understand what happens after they've gone through all the work to apply. What happens to those projects, I guess?
Chair Reed, Representative Lively. So if I understand your question correctly, the list starts over each okay. Connect one as we've gone through the program. That isn't to say we prioritize the whole list, mm-hmm. And the commission actually does that. And many times, because of the agreement that we do with the projects and the fact that they're reimbursable, sometimes we end up with money left over. So, you know, we select for the $100 million, and then over time you have a million or so left. What we've done in the past is roll that into the next Connect program. So instead of having, because we do take out for some administrative costs, we add that money into the next one. And there was, I believe, in the Connect 1 process, where there was a couple of times where we hadn't fully funded the project, and when more money came in, we were able to fully fund those projects. So we've made a few of those slight changes with each of the program. So.
Nothing prevents people from reapplying then. I made the list, they start over, but it could be they can keep applying for funds and hope they get up on the priority list.
Chair Reed, Representative Lively, definitely. And I can tell you that, you know, my staff has often worked with applicants about what was good, what was bad, how to sure. strengthen it. So,
good.
I'm really interested in that point you made, or the question you asked about how many, if yeah. any, proceed without funding from Connect Oregon. If their application, if the project is improved by the process of the Connect Oregon application, even if it's not successful and they can find funding in other sources, that would be interesting too. If you can maybe help us follow up on that.
Chair Reed, I will do my best to see if we can answer that question.
Thank you. Representative Benson, then Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's hard to find folks that don't like the outcome of the projects because they're all at some level necessary. The challenge I've found in looking back at everything that's done, it's all good, it's all great, but it's how it fits into the bigger picture of what we use lottery monies for. That's not what quite has happened here. The governor suggests a number. Everyone says this is a great project, so how much more can we get? And then we dump it into the existing process to allocate the funds. That's the sequence. And the conversation I would like to, of course, have is maybe better suited for Ways and Means, but you know, where one is trying to decide if this is the right way to spend this money. So set that part aside and leave that for some of the day. And just go to making Connect Oregon better suited to withstand that kind of Ways and Means debate. And when I look at those list of justifications, some of them are very easily met. And in your opinion, which one is the most challenging and difficult for the applicant? And how would you recommend that we tighten those up to make the projects that are funded so urgent they must have state money to justify themselves, as opposed to being kind of a treasure chest we all reach into whenever we want to do something?
Chair Reed, Representative Bentz, I think for each project, the criteria can be more difficult, but what we do as staff is that there's five criteria that's identified, five we call them considerations, actually, that's in the bill, is that we tier them. So if an application meets all five, it gets a certain level of points. If it meets all four, it gets a lower level of points. And so we tier it 1, 2, and 3. And that's the information that we provide both to our modal committee members as well as our regional committee members.
Is that just a binary sort of met or not met?
We actually do points.
Okay.
So it's like 40 to 50 is a tier is tier 1, 31 to 40 is tier 2. And so so staff actually does have points identified for each of the criteria that we go through. And then that's the information that we provide to the modal committees as a starting point. We don't require that they use those necessarily, but it is a good starting point for their conversation. What we have found as we've gone through these four programs is that the modal committees will prioritize their projects and our regional committees will prioritize their projects. And there is amazing synergy between kind of their top tier as well as the bottom tier, those that they think are really good and those that they think, you know, just are not good for the program. And it's that middle area that the final review committee has a lot of conversation. But I would say that it's the top 25% that we've seen with final review committee, there's pretty overall agreement, whether you're a modal representative or whether you're a regional representative, and the same for the bottom. And so then you always negotiate in the middle. And that's usually where the conversation goes.
Paula,
I hope that answers your question sufficiently.
Well, it's... No, it doesn't. Here's the question. The question is, when I look at those five areas, I was looking for one that said, if we don't do this, we're going to forever lose the railroad out of Lakeview. That's the sense of urgency there, because once you've lost a railroad, it's pretty much gone, or Coos Bay. And so that urgency element, I was looking through those five and trying to find it. Is it there?
Chair Reed, Representative Bentz, the first three are the critical ones. The last one, whether proposed transportation project is ready for construction, obviously we want to make sure that the money keeps moving. That's an important consideration, but I wouldn't say is critical in your definition. But it's, I think the part that you have to recognize is that there's a difference between a transit project and, say, a rail project and what they're trying to achieve. You know, transit project, critical link, it's, you know, it's getting folks to jobs, whereas a rail project could be more around reducing transportation costs, you know, so we are able to move on the rail much cheaper than some of the truck when you're talking aggregate and some of those things. So that's, you have to look at this kind of modal specific when you're looking at the considerations, certainly A, B, and C. So that's one of the tricky parts of this program is identifying considerations that can cross modes versus, you know, criteria that is mode specific that gets you, you know, what is the actual priority for a rail project. But when you're looking at what is the priority for a rail project against an aviation project, against a transit project, against a marine project, it's a different conversation.
Right. I understand that part. But the part that is of greatest challenge to me is seeing how we take this extremely limited amount of money and make sure that it is being used for the highest priority item. And there's a lot of subjectivity in making that decision. So to the extent that we can impose upon that process something that makes my ability to justify spending this money easier. Because for example, I want to go back to the Coos Bay Rail Line. That is a necessary part of that community, hugely important, and there's a space between maybe what might happen in that town in the future, and you got to keep the railroad line waiting for that, and then all of a sudden it takes on terrific value. So there's a there's a really good reason to spend that money there for that purpose, a really, really high-level reason. And so how can we take that? Because I've seen other projects that don't enjoy that type of explanation at all. I'm glad we have them. Everybody's doing better for it, but doesn't quite raise to that level of maybe needing having to spend the money that way.
Right. Chair Reed, Representative Benz, I think, you know, that's the idea of the two layers of the process, because in a certain way you're getting at what's a statewide priority, perhaps, versus a regional. And so I believe that our modal committees are really looking at, you know, whether it's rail or whether it's transit, from a statewide perspective, where do you get the biggest bang for your buck? And the regional, they have, you know, they are looking at their community, obviously, as we all do. So that's where I was saying that when you can see good, you know, a quarter to a third of them where they both marry up.
Yes.
And, you know, in the other portion where they both agree, it's the discussion in the middle that is the balance between the regional and the state and how you have that discussion. And it is an art and not a science. And I'm not sure that because of the diversity of the types of projects, I think the process that we have gets us to the best science that we can get to. But there is still a little bit of trust that you're taking as to with the two committees as you prioritize and exactly what comes out of the application. So, and some of it, though, that's also part of this is leverage. Rail projects and some of our aviation projects had a very high leverage. So we were, the rural airports, there was a lot of FAA money that the state would not have gotten if we didn't have the money for the rural airports in order to provide the match. So it's kind of different situations depending on the mode and the issue at hand.
Go ahead. Yeah, well, I understand that 95 to 5 or whatever that leverage was, it was pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. And that might be the urgency that I'm seeking in each of these, because that kind of program may not be, I'm sure isn't going to be around very much longer, but the point is, how can we make sure that whatever the criteria we choose to impose results in the very highest standard for the spending of these really rare monies? And that's what I'm going to be looking at as we continue the dialogue.
Representative Nathanson, and then Representative Davis.
Thank you very much. I want to follow up on a couple of things we've been hearing about so far. I was interested in the response about the list and some of the projects maybe then happen subsequently anyway. How do we know whether is some of the money that we provided as grants, we really only needed to have provided half of it or for that particular project? And how much do we provide in loans? For example, I'm thinking about Business Oregon does an awful lot of loaning, and loans get repaid, and it's what was needed to get something started and to help it be successful. So how much do we do with loans versus grants? And how do we determine that this project really needs 100% when we have such a small amount compared to the size of the need?
Chair Reed, Representative Nathanson. So I believe, actually, out of the four programs, we may have had two loans. And that's really been the choice of the applicant. So we've never identified a certain percentage needing to go to loans or any of that. So it's been done from an application standpoint. This is a reimbursable program. So we do agreements with the applicant. And we have a series of milestones. So because an applicant says a project's going to cost X and it ends up costing something less than X, they don't get those extra funds. On the flip side, sometimes we've had, and they never get additional funds, but sometimes we do have to rescope the projects because of the limited funds. So it does work both ways, but they don't get just what they ask for. We work very diligently to identify exactly what are the costs and making sure that they get reimbursed at that level.
seems like it would be pretty easy for everyone to just say, I would rather you grant me the money rather than ask for a loan. How do you determine that, again, given our limited resources, we probably could have done okay by providing a loan in certain circumstances? You know, and again, I understand it depends on leveraging other private or public investment that's going to join it. But still, you know, everyone would just say, oh, yeah, I'll take $1,000. I don't need a loan. That's easy.
Representative Reed, Representative Nathanson, I think that could be something for you to consider about what percentage should go to loans. For local governments, they're usually, you know, looking that many of our smaller communities are really struggling with the match. There's a 20% match, so let alone having a loan program. Mm-hmm. So it hasn't been an area that we've it's allowed under here, but we actually haven't pursued as saying this is, you know, should this project be a loan versus a grant. That hasn't been a question that we've asked.
Okay, and just one other follow-up. Yep. Thank you. You mentioned there are five considerations or five criteria areas. You described how points are assigned, you know, maybe 1 to 10 or something. How well does it meet that criteria? For the criteria, for the five considerations, are those weighted equally?
Been a while, Representative Nathan. It's been a while since I've looked at that. I believe they are. For instance, I know on the leveraging one, we did break that out depending on how much they were leveraging. So, for instance, we learned, and I can't remember which Connect program, that we were giving the same amount of points whether you were adding 21% of your, you know, of your match versus 40% of your match. Obviously, that doesn't quite work. So we've made some changes there. The other thing, when we're looking at kind of the jobs created and jobs retained, we work with Business Oregon. So we actually have our economists and Business Oregon looking to see, you know, how reliable are those numbers. And I will tell you, you know, with each Connect program, we recognize there's some limitations and we make some improvements. For instance, out of Connect 4, there's now requirement when they finish with the project, I believe it's 18 months out, you know, did they retain or create the jobs that they identified within their application? So in the back of the report, we surveyed folks, but there wasn't the requirement. The other thing is that we've put in place performance measures with regards in Connect 4 with regards to what's appropriate, whether it's a transit project, whether it's a rail project, so we can start to measure and see if we're really reaching the outcomes that we want to. So those are two changes that came out of the Connect 4 process. Quite honestly, was in with conversation with our Transportation Commission, and they were saying these are some of the things that we need. So those are probably our two most recent changes that with the Connect Oregon 5 program, obviously, we would keep going. So
perhaps it was in the report, but I think I missed the performance measures. Is it in the report, or is it somewhere else?
Representative Reed, it's not in the report because it doesn't exist yet. So there's for the Connect 4 project.
If you could provide us some info on that would be very helpful too.
I can, Representative Reed, I can provide you examples of the performance measures that we've put in the agreements.
That'd be terrific.
Glad
and
to
for
do
the,
that.
For the whole committee, would be great. Thank you.
Glad
anything
to
else from you? Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Two questions. How quickly after an application is money generally made available? And this goes to Representative Bent's point about urgency. If we're going to have this system and it's going to be for urgent projects to improve Oregon's transportation, it seems to me it should be funded quickly. And the second question is, I see the selection criteria in the report, but not the applicant criteria. And I noticed that a lot of these programs do appear to directly benefit private companies. Some of them go to public entities. Is there a requirement that if it's going to go to a private company, that there's some public entity that's also co-applicant with them or is also providing testimony and support?
Chair Reed, Representative, let's see if I can answer all of your questions. So With regards to a private entity, there isn't a joint application with the local government. But we do, for instance, make sure that everybody is up on their taxes, do that type of scrutiny, that they actually own the property. These projects also have to have a life of 20 years. Okay. With regards to how quickly the monies are made available, one of the things that we learned through the Connect Oregon process is that we have agreements that we have to do with each of the applicants. And there were some things in the agreements that some of the applicants had, they struggled with, such as the 20-year. And so we now have a draft agreement that goes in as part of the application process so that they understand what they're going to have to sign on to, so if they don't want to sign on to that. So as quickly as the agreement is done is as quickly as the individual, the applicants, can start to do construction and then get reimbursed. We really try to get all of the agreements done within the first 6 months. And some take up to that 6 months, and a lot of them are done after the first month. We can get them out. We get them out very quickly after the commission approves the projects. It's just a matter of time and, you know, working back and forth with the applicant to get an agreement that everybody can concur on. So, and then they're free to work on their project.
Quick follow-up,
please.
Thank you, Chair. So we're talking about up to 6 months to actually come to an agreement. I understand that as a lawyer, the business negotiation piece. And it's great that there's a draft agreement. How quickly after an application, generally speaking, does the committee approve a project? Do we know that?
So, Chair Reed, Representative Davis, so the commission approves the projects, say, they approved them in August. Mm-hmm. September 1st, we start working with the applicants with regards to the agreement. And as quickly as those are done, then they can start doing their work. And then it's reimbursed, and we move the bills through very quickly. So the agreement on the projects has actually occurred before our commission has taken action on the project list before we work on the agreements.
That's my question, is how quickly is that process? I get the second part, the agreement. I'm talking about the first part. I send in my forms. How long after that do I wait to get a response and a decision?
Excuse me. Representative Reed, Representative Davis. Because of the fact that we work with modal committees and regional committees, even a very quick process is, I think last time took us 14, 15 months before the commission gaveled down on it.
Thank you.
Looks like we may have exhausted our technical questions for you for the moment, but please stick around. We may generate some more as we hear from other folks.
Thank you
very much for great testimony. Ralph Saperstein, Janet Jarvis, and Ann and Craig, are you trying to come up together, or do you matter to you? We got one seat amongst the three. That's the only reason I'm asking. If you want to wait, we have another option too. Come on up, Ann. Thanks.
I'll have better protection with Ann and Janet.
It's Friday afternoon.
Whoever would like to start is fine with us.
I'll go first then. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Janet Jarvis, here today on behalf of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. We have long been a supporter of the Connect Oregon program. I think it was mentioned earlier that business needs competitive transportation options, and that is especially true for agricultural producers in this state. Agriculture is an industry where the grower pays the freight to and from the farm, and they don't have the ability to build the transportation costs into their product pricing, if you think about growing commodity crops. And so they're directly impacted by the availability and the accessibility of affordable modes of transportation and increased efficiencies. If you think about wheat in particular, half of Oregon's wheat is grown in the four counties ranging from Sherman County to Umatilla County. But wheat is actually grown in 22 of Oregon's 36 counties. And so in a variety of areas around the state, there are a number of challenges in efficiently and cost-effectively getting product to market. 90% of Oregon's wheat is exported, the bulk of it coming up through one of the ports on the Columbia River. So we are supportive of this program, would encourage you to continue to support this program, and ask for your support of House Bill 2310.
Thank you very much. Yes.
My name is Ann Hannes. For the record, I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. Chair Reed, members of the committee, AOC strongly supports Connect Oregon. You have my testimony before you, but that really goes into why we think this is an important program because of the benefits it provides to our economy and that it affects and benefits all regions of the state. I just want to make a couple comments regarding the process itself. We found the process to be a collaborative one that's involved the acts and the various modes. That kind of give and take among the acts and the modes we found to be very constructive in identifying projects that are of high priority. It also, we also really like the fact that at least 10% has to go into each one of the five different regions. That's ensured that there are projects throughout the state that benefit, you know, all areas of the state, and also reserves half of the money to be able to focus on areas of regional or statewide priority. So we do applaud ODOT for how they have handled the process and their painstaking involvement with all the acts and the modes. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Saperstein.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Ralph Saperstein. I'm here representing Boise Cascade and the Coos-Siskiyou Shippers Coalition. The Shippers Coalition was formed, and you heard from Port Commissioner, the Port of Coos Bay Commissioner, in 2007 when the Central Oregon and Pacific Railroad shut down immediately, and our mills and American Bridge and everybody else was without rail service. And so we formed our coalition to show that there's broad-based, broad-based community support for restoring those railroads. And fortunately now the Coos Bay Rail has opened, and we've got other projects. And Mr. Chair, you asked us to comment, and Representative Bentz did, about the selection process. And for Connect Oregon 4, we came in number two and got funded, so I think it's a great process. and some of the previous awards have resulted in the, there's a new switching yard in Winchester, which is just north of Roseburg, that's working very well, keeping the trains out of blocking downtown Roseburg traffic. But this summer, we have two projects that are important. We're increasing the tunnel sizes, both from Glendale to Grants Pass and from Ashland to Yreka, California. And the Ashland and Yreka is going to be done under a federal Tiger grant for $14 million. But this will allow us to use high-capacity cars, train cars, that won't fit in the old tunnels. And these hold 20% more. And so this is, it, our lumber mills and plywood mills will take advantage of that. And that keeps trucks off the road. We, you know, keep, had we spent 30 years keeping our rail lines up, we probably wouldn't have the highway traffic issue we have now. And so the least we can do now is continue to invest in these projects. For the short lines, the main lines are fine. The short lines to get to all parts of Oregon are very important, and we think it's been a big success. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Representative Nathanson.
It's not a question, but it's a comment. I think many of us feel the urgency about maintaining, really not just maintaining, but upgrading and upgrading our rail system for both freight and passenger rail, as well as making sure that we're maintaining and upgrading airports and marine ports and so forth. But it is interesting when the jargon is our rail lines or our this or our that, when some of it is private facilities, not public facilities. And that's where it gets really tricky. How do we help through public actions or public money, how do we maintain something that is so critical to Oregon's infrastructure and our state and regional economy when there's a real critical distinction and a balance between private interest and public interest? I just think it's pretty tricky.
Tricky is true.
One brief question, or Representative Cameron, go ahead.
Thank you. That just kind of prompted me, Ralph, of a question. Is there any kind of other industries over in Coos Bay, if we were allowed to let them develop, would help a private railroad be successful?
Oh, absolutely.
Can you talk about some of those for us?
They have big plans with the Port of Coos Bay for coal trains and LNG and those things. The rail line is the best tie to the Interstate 5 corridor. The highways aren't very efficient going from Coos Bay to I-5, so the rail lines are critical. American Bridge came to Reedsport, and then they lost the ability to use the rail line when it closed in 2007. So Coos Bay sees themselves, and I'm sure Representative McCune will speak to the things that can happen with the rail line in Coos Bay.
Follow up, if I may. So what you're saying is some of those other private industries or public private concepts that would create some other activity over there using natural resources would potentially support a private railroad that wouldn't have to be publicly subsidized.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative McEwen, I thought you might have some.
Why didn't she answer before?
You were going to say, Mr. Sexton.
Actually, I hadn't prepared any testimony today, but since the topic has come up, we have a number of shippers on the line right now who are very critical to the economy of the South Coast, and they include such companies as Roseburg Forest Products, Georgia Pacific, American Bridge. We have mills up on the east end of the line in Lane County that are utilizing our services right now. We have organic dairy farmers in the Coquille Valley who are bringing in organic grain from the Midwest and from Idaho. We have a number of wood products industries, South Coast Lumber, Conrad Wood Preserving, who are also using the line right now. But I think the critical piece is that there are opportunities for a port who has gone from a very robust economy of about 300 ships a year down to about 30 ships a year because of changes in market conditions, to a port that's poised to grow significantly in a number of ways, which allows us to move all kinds of different types of cargo. Bulk cargoes of different sorts, liquid cargoes, wood products, wood chips, manufactured wood pellets. In fact, I think the comment about the TriMet Bridge project with American Bridge building the 34 components that are going to build the new TriMet Bridge are really critical. So it's not limited to a cargo. We have multiple opportunities to grow and to energize a port and to, in that regard, energize an entire region with a line that is publicly owned now, was private, was abandoned, was purchased by the port at the urgence of our federal and state delegations and our private shippers who were captured, which we did, the port did, and now is poised for growth for an entire region. So I just wanted to make it clear that there are a number of things that the port does. We have opportunities for lots of different types of growth, but the rail line is key infrastructure. It was built in 1913, needs work, obviously. We've done a lot of that already, but we have more that we need to do. So I just thank you for letting me toss that in there.
I told you her answer would be better.
Very much.
And it is a, I'm sorry, may I, one more thing. The public-private piece is very interesting. This was a private rail line for many, many years and was not well cared for. So we're making up for lost time. It is public now. And I think it puts us in a very different place. At some point, maybe this rail line could be private. Maybe it could be owned by a different entity. But there was no one but the port to step up and purchase it and get it back operating. And so there are opportunities in the future to do different things with it. Right now, it's just poised for growth.
And in fact, I was on the Transportation Committee when we had that conversation about it, about the terrible state it was in. So mm-hmm. There's a long and interesting history around that we can probably take up offline. But
I can give you a whole presentation on it someday.
I'm sure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your testimony. Next up, Craig Honeyman, John Charles, and John Ledger. You decide the order, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Craig Honeyman, Legislative Director of the League of Oregon Cities. We represent all 242 cities in the state of Oregon. I'm here to support House Bill 2310 and Connect Oregon 5. To keep my comments brief, I'll associate my remarks with those of Ms. Hannes from AOC, who preceded me on a prior panel. I'll point out that these projects, 35 of them at least, over Connect Oregon's 1 through 4, have materially benefited approximately 35 cities in the state, whether it's a terminal expansion in Redmond or a runway extension in Ontario, a rail spur in Baker City, a transit facility in Sandy, or a streetcar extension and project in Portland. These are all good projects. They're contributing to the infrastructure needs and job creation around the state. We particularly like the fact that this legislation continues the mandated allocation through the five regions of the state, which Ms. Bohart previously described. We're very supportive of that. I'll close by saying Chair Reed, as you indicated earlier in your opening remarks, this is probably a conversation that needs to be had later in the Ways and Means process, but I want to inform this committee that the League has identified infrastructure needs, non-transportation infrastructure needs, principally water, wastewater, recreation, that are at least the equal of the transportation infrastructure needs. So as we discuss the amounts, we hope that this legislature keeps other infrastructure needs that cities face in mind as well. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
And just before we turn on, we hope you will be back on February 27th when this committee will have, I hope, an interesting conversation about infrastructure more generally.
Yes, sir.
Thanks. Mr. Charles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute. And since this is a policy committee, not a Ways and Means committee, I'll try to make a few policy points here about this approach. When you've been doing this for four rounds, what you have are always a series of compelling stories from past grant and loan recipients. And they are compelling. And I'm glad to hear that people have built useful things with money. But there's a bigger picture here, a bigger policy picture, which is that when you decide to turn the state legislature into sort of a philanthropy, the list of people lining up to get the money doesn't shrink. It always grows. And you can't really escape from that. And so inevitably, you're starting to not only spend the money you have, it's the money you hope to have. So over the last 15 years, the trend has been to securitize future revenue streams, vast amounts of revenue streams from gas taxes, from hoped for tobacco taxes, from lottery funds. So you're securitizing everything to spend now and have compelling stories, recipients, but you also are foreclosing your options in the future and the options of your successors because you've spent the money and you can't really get off of that. It wasn't always this way. There was a time not too long ago when infrastructure, multimodal infrastructure, not just highways, was privately financed before the state started crowding private investors out. You probably know of the Barlow Toll Road, which Mr. Barlow only took 5 weeks to come down here and get the permission to do that and go invest in private funds to create the Barlow Toll Road in 1846. Many people, entrepreneurs, operated privately financed river ferries. The first crossing over the Willamette River, the Morrison Bridge, in 1887 was built by a couple of California entrepreneurs at their own risk, and they recovered their capital and operating costs from user fees from those who directly benefited. And those are stories from another era, but as recently as 1968, even all of the bus transit in the Portland region was provided by private, for-profit, dividend-paying companies. And since they were deliberately put out of business by the city of Portland so they could create the vast bureaucracy known as TriMet, the amount of money that has disappeared into that entity and now shrinking service is phenomenal. So private investment would work again for all of these projects, but you're crowding it out for one thing, and the second is there is private investment all over the world happening, but to try and build something today in Oregon, you face a really daunting permitting and regulatory task of potentially a decade or more of soft costs at your own expense before you can get to yes. So I think instead of trying to figure out how to do Connect 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, perhaps you should start to shut this program down and look at solving these other problems that make these regulatory and permitting problems and make it so difficult for the billions of dollars of private capital circling the globe looking for a safe place to land, which by and large is unlikely to land in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Charles. Mr. Ledger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. We have about 1,400 members. About 300 to 400 of them are manufacturers. And they're scattered all around the state. Most of them are small. And shipping and freight, being able to move freight is a critical item to them, and it's also important for their expansions. We think this is a good program. We think it helps vitalize communities, create jobs, and it creates opportunities, frankly, that we cannot imagine. People will do amazing things if you give them the opportunity to start a facility or a plant somewhere, and it's difficult to project what it will be. But we think this is a successful nuts and bolts program, and the last thing I want to say is we want to thank you for funding this over the years when we know there have been a lot of pressures on the finances of the state, and we hope it will be funded as much as possible and move to the governor's desk. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? I don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Jody Weiser, Mark Landauer, and Jonathan Manton, please. Jody, you're sitting first. Would you like to start?
I will. Chair Reed and committee, for the record, I'm Jody Weiser. I'm here with Tax Fairness Oregon. And we started looking at Connect Oregon and have gone to a lot of those different meetings that have occurred since the last round, because we read in Willamette Week that a lot of the money was going to Union Pacific. And it was kind of like hard to imagine how this was really how public funds should be spent, since they reported 33% profit in the last year. Another hunk of money is going to Burlington Northern. They reported 19% profit last year. Those are pretty high profit levels for, and it was hard to imagine why those companies needed us to make their tunnels taller or their bridges stronger, since they clearly had the capability. Since Connect Oregon was started, the words, you know, that were said in the original law and in the law, the bill before you, is that it was to help assist local governments and businesses that don't have the financial or technical capacity to do large transportation projects by themselves. We support the concept of developing infrastructure and job creation as long as it has broad benefits and it really goes to those who don't have the capacity or the technical ability themselves. So far, we found one loan, and all the rest of the $340 million that have been spent have gone as grants. The percentage of it that has gone to private business has gone from 29 to 49%, just increasing each with each biennium. And the consequence of that is that this biennium, the general fund, is paying $95 million of debt towards the already constructed Connect Oregon projects. $95 million is a week of school. So a kid that's entering school now will, you know, miss a lot of weeks of school because we did this as grants rather than loans. So as you can see on the attachment that I gave you, there's you can see how the breakdown has changed over time and what the amounts have been. with that, those things in mind, you know, our concerns as we went and looked and saw what we saw, we've come up with some recommendations about how the program could be changed. We think that it should be primarily a loan or loan guarantee program instead of a grant program. By providing loans instead of grants, after time, the program will become self-sufficient. If you retained the interest that you earned, that would cover the costs of running the program that the state has, and they're pretty big. They do a lot at the Department of Transportation for this program. And if there happen to be losses, which I doubt, because these are big projects that are going forward, it would cover that. And then you would pretty soon you would have a fund that could be granting the money each year or each biennium. If it's a loan program, you would of course need to make sure that the applicants were loan worthy, and it would mean that the loans would need to be repaid by the businesses or the individuals who are actually getting the benefit of the infrastructure changes that we're helping create. And it makes sense that if you're UPS and you're flying into an airport, you should be paying something towards maintaining that airport. It shouldn't all come from state funds or federal funds, and that's the way it's been. We've been matching our own federal funds, basically, and the users of the airport haven't been paying for the infrastructure improvements. The benefits should also generally go to situations where the benefit is broadly based instead of benefiting a single business. So when Roseburg Lumber, one of the biggest lumber companies in the Northwest, wants to change its connection to a major railroad line, it's hard to understand why the grocery store clerk should be responsible for that, and yet that's what Connect Oregon has paid for. So if you're giving grants or loans, then it needs to have a basis in the jobs created. We saw some projects that would obviously actually decrease the need for jobs because you're mechanizing something that people have been doing. There's nothing in the evaluation that gives a minus score for actually decreasing jobs. And the truck drivers that are off the roads are probably going to miss their jobs when you put something on a rail car. And there's also nothing in it that looks at the environmental benefits, and that probably should be added to the evaluation since that would offset the trucks are off and it's way less fuel, way less debilitating for the environment to put the product on a train instead of on a truck.
So yeah, I notice you've got a number of our other recommendations. I'm just looking at the list of people we have to yet to testify. So if you could summarize, that would.
Okay. Well, you have they're all dotted. You have them in front of you, and basically, I think that they speak for themselves and their copies for the rest of for the audience as well. But so I'd say another really important thing. I can't understand how the original scoring by the department was created, because basically it would be a choice of did you create jobs and kind of how many per million, or did you increase safety, how likely it is the safety is going to happen. And you look at those two items and you score them, and then you take the higher score. Well, those are two really independent things, and they should be scored independently. And that would be part of the whole process. If you kind of think of it all globally, you don't end up really looking at the science of it, which you're trying to get to. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Jonathan.
Thank you, Chair Reed and members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Manton, and I'm here testifying today on behalf of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. I want to spend a few moments just talking about some of these broad-based benefits economically as well as job creation that results from bicycle pedestrian infrastructure projects. As you know, the bike ped projects are not eligible in current for Connect Oregon funds currently. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your leadership on this issue. We're working with Legislative Council on an amendment that we hope you will support ultimately to allow bike ped projects to become eligible for Connect Oregon funds. And I just want to walk you through a couple of studies, some of the highlights very quickly, and I submitted both studies in my testimony today, so I'll just kind of quickly hit a couple of the highlights. The first is a University of Massachusetts Amherst study that found that bicycle infrastructure projects generate 30% more jobs per $1 million spent compared to road infrastructure projects. So you get a lot of job bang for your buck. And then there are a number in the second study. This is called Bicycling Means Business, the Economic Benefits of Bicycle Infrastructure, in which a number of economic impact studies from around the country are cited. In Wisconsin, there was a 2010 study found that bicycle recreation and tourism contributes $924 million to the state's economy and estimates the potential value of health benefits from reducing short car trips and increasing bicycling totaling $409 million. University of Northern Iowa found that commuter and recreational bicycling in Iowa generated more than $400 million in economic activity, resulting in health savings of $87 million. Minnesota, Department of Employment and Economic Development, bicycle rider spending came to $261 million. That's spending on behalf of the bicyclers. This spending supported more than 5,000 jobs, helped generate $35 million in taxes. Colorado Department of Transportation in 2000 determined that bicycling contributed $1 billion, that's with a B, to the economy from manufacturing, retail, tourism, and bike racing. Retail and manufacturers employed 1,213 people with an annual payroll of $34.1 million. In Vermont, economic impact of walking and biking shows that in 2009, biking and walking created at least 1,400 jobs, $41 million in wages, and $83 million in revenue. In addition, the health and property value benefits could bump that up by more than $400 million. I'll speak to a second study just a second, mentioning the property value increases that come with these projects. In Maine, since 1991, Maine made a concerted effort to improve its bicycle infrastructure by widening shoulders and creating shared use paths that between 91 and 2001 generated $66 million a year in bicycle tourism. I'm getting there. Memphis, Tennessee. Bicycle lanes are part of the city's Broad Avenue Arts District initiative. According to local business leaders, the popularity of the project exploded when the focus was expanded to include bicycles. Since the beginning of that project, the district has seen 16 new businesses, 29 property renovations, 40,000 visitors to the Arts Walk. Restaurants have reported a growth in business from bicycle riders. The Memphis Food Truckers Association recently began weekly food truck rodeos on Broad Avenue. Fast forward. In a wide-ranging survey in 2008, total revenue from recreational road biking events topped $240 million. Two-thirds of those 08 riders were tied to a cause, raising an additional $200 million for that cause. Riders spent nearly $140 million on food, lodging, and other purchases at these events. And this is the home values, which I found particularly interesting. Bob McNamara, a senior policy representative from the National Association of Realtors, 1.2 million member professional organization, emphasized the importance of transportation choice at the 2009 National Bike Summit. Realtors sell not just houses, he said, they sell communities. Increasing transportation choice increases livability. In 2008, the National Association of Realtors revised its policy statement on transportation to call for the consideration of all transportation types, including bicycling, in every transportation project.
Jonathan, I'm guessing you have already highlighted all those portions. Maybe you can share them electronically with us and just give us the bottom line.
Absolutely. That was the last one.
Oh, well, perfect for me to interrupt then. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. I just will make one quick mention that in yesterday's testimony over on the House side, Bob Russell of Truckers Association provided some useful data on recent polling showing that the request from folks out in the rural communities is just statewide. For bike ped projects is significant. We've had a big increase since in the last few years. And he was talking about in some of the testimony after me, I think we'll talk to the aging population. We have seniors in some of the rural areas that want access to the store, that don't want to be driving anymore. And so the bike ped funding projects really chips in and allows them to enjoy a higher quality of life. So with that, I will be quiet and thank you so much for the valuable time that you let me have.
Thank you very much. Mr. Landauer.
Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Public Ports Association. Our public ports represent 23 public ports from as far south as Brookings Harbor, north to Astoria, and as far east to the port of Umatilla. I have served on the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee and also served on the governor's non-roadway funding task force. And from those discussions, it is very clear that the non-roadway needs in this state far outstrip the available resources. Ms. Lessine and Mr. Koch previously spoke about their individual port support for this program, and I want to express our association's support for this program. And the one change, Mr. Chair, that I would like to suggest is that you keep the $100 million in this round's bill rather than the $40 million that was provided last
Very
session.
Very clever definition of a change. Thank
yes,
you.
Yes. Well, in any event, our state's competitiveness is highly dependent on our ability, not only regionally, nationally, but globally, to have an efficient transportation system. Historically, our members have competed rather well in this process, and having sat on the Freight Advisory Committee, I can assure you, at least from my experience, they look at these applications with a very critical eye, and I believe that the competition for these limited funds is very, very robust. Our membership has a very diverse set of assets, not only rail, as was mentioned previously, but obviously also marine and air. So our members have a very unique interest in this program, and we hope that you will continue this program and support it, not only now, but also in the future, because the needs, again, are very great, and we know that the resources are small, but oftentimes these resources serve as the gap between making these projects actually turn dirt and sit on a desk in blueprints. So thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
Just a comment. Mr. Manton, it's nice to see in your Massachusetts study that the city of Eugene was a participant. So we have some local information in that study. Thank you.
Chair Reed, Representative McCann, thank you for pointing that out. Appreciate that.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Next up, Chris Rawl, Steph Routh, and Chris Hagerbrenner.
So, Chair Reed, members of the committee, I'm Chris Rawl. I'm the Pacific Northwest Field Organizer for Transportation for America. T4 America is a coalition comprised of over 500 organizations with diverse interests, real estate, housing, environmental, public health, business, transportation, and equitable development. We're all working to align transportation policy with 21st century challenges. And helping to foster a transportation system that's safer, cleaner, smarter, and has more options for everyone. Most recently, we've focused our efforts on MAP 21, the federal transportation bill that finally passed last summer. Unfortunately, MAP 21 was a far cry from what we might have hoped to see in terms of funding levels and accountability to move our transportation system into the 21st century. However, it could have been a lot worse. Our coalition helped stop a proposal to cut transportation funding, federal transportation funding, across the board by a third. T for America also authored a sign-on letter with over with nearly 700 signatories in approximately 24 hours, including Governors Kitzhaber, Gregoire, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, AFL-CIO, and numerous local elected officials. And that was to stop a proposal to end dedicated funding for transit by kicking it out of the Highway Trust Fund, which would have crippled transit systems all over the country. At this stage, we're working to illustrate the opportunities for states within MAP 21. And here in Oregon, that's meant convening conversations with local stakeholders to address challenges that are unique to Oregon. Change and opportunity are upon us whether we like it or not. Despite the population increases here, Oregonians are driving 6% less than they were 10 years ago. Overall, young Americans are driving 23% less and own 30% fewer cars than 10 years ago. So this trend actually bodes well for Oregon. Transportation options save Oregonians money, give them more disposable income to support local business. Walking, biking, or running to catch the bus or the MAX train means physical activity, which makes for healthier families and a more productive workforce. This shift also reduces traffic congestion, greenhouse gases, and other pollution. But the shift in how we get around presents funding challenges. Oregon has one of the most strict constitutional restrictions on the use of motor vehicle fees, and has no sales tax. the Business Energy Tax Credit and the heavily oversubscribed ODOT Flex Fund program, which funded transportation options, are both all but gone. And the federal gas tax has not been increased since 1993, so substantial new federal revenue is unlikely in the near future. That means that at the same time that less money is being generated, Oregonians and the future dominant generation in particular are shifting to other modes of transportation, and these are modes that currently have incomplete networks and a shortage of funding. How do we complete those networks so that the neighborhoods and families have affordable, healthy transportation options in their community to safely get to work, school, shopping, church, community events? Conversations we've held and joined have coalesced around a concept called Connect Oregon Plus as a near-term step. Connect Oregon Plus would begin to meet some of the most challenging funding problems for our state's transportation system, including public transit operations. We understand there's an amendment in the works, and thank Chair Reed for helping with the work that's been going on that to make bicycle and pedestrian projects eligible under Connect Oregon 5. This does not address the critical challenge of transit operations funding, but it would move Oregon a step closer to the plus consensus vision that's been discussed. Bike and pedestrian projects would compete under the same criteria as port, rail, aviation, and transit capital projects on a level playing field. I hope you'll carefully consider how this amendment would give the Connect program more tools and options for achieving its goals. We offer ourselves as a resource as these conversations continue and Oregon looks to address 21st century transportation challenges. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Rath.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you for having us here today, and in honor of your weekend, I will attempt to be brief. My name is Stephanie Ralph. I'm Executive Director of Oregon Walks. We're a nonprofit organization committed to encouraging walking and making the conditions for walking safe, convenient, and attractive for everyone. We're here in enthusiastic support of the potential amendments that Mr. Manton referred to and a number of the economic studies that he referenced for biking also relate to walking as well, particularly that of property values and resilience in communities and avoidance of foreclosures. I wanted to speak to Representative Davis's bringing the point of urgency, and the urgency in walking is really about pedestrian safety. Looking at ODOT's annual performance progress reports, the number of pedestrians injured in 2010 and 11 actually exceed the national average. Oregon's is 21%, and the national average is 19%. In 2012, the preliminary reports of pedestrian fatalities actually rose from the 2011 by 30%. So I think we're seeing a pretty significant issue related to pedestrian safety that needs to be urgently addressed. Mr. Rawls mentioned a number of financial challenges we're dealing with, and I think that Connect Oregon would be a great way to fund some critically needed pedestrian biking improvements. And I'll just end with a story actually I told on the Senate side earlier this week, and that's I'm a fourth-generation Oregonian, and I want to tell the story of my gramps. So his first vehicle was a horse, and his favorite vehicle was a Model A Ford, and I retain a picture of him propped over it, and he led a life of in the timber industry in Tillamook County, a swashbuckling, fiery, independent spirit throughout his life until he came to a point where he, as he was aging, as so many of us do, his mobility changed as his aging progressed, and at one point he had to lose his license. It wasn't renewed, and which was a difficult conversation when my dad had to take the keys to his truck. I did not want to be my dad at that point in time. And then he was on the difficult, tough, slightly humiliating circumstance of having to ask to be ferried by family members to the grocery store. And I think one thing, we're looking at an aging population by 2040. One in five Oregonians are going to be over the age of 65, and we need to prepare for that. We need to start now. And I think that people like my grandfather, who have helped build this great state and its legacy with their own two hands, deserve the dignity of aging in place. And I think Connect Oregon with amendments for biking and ped would get us there. So thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy your weekend.
Tamara, before you get started, I will note that we have your written testimony, yep. So no need to read it if you were planning to.
Right. Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Chris Hagerbaumer. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Environmental Council, and I envy you your jobs. I don't envy you your jobs, because most of the time it feels like people are coming in front of you and they're asking for money, right? And you have this limited pot of money to give away, and everybody's trying to sort of jockey and say, my needs are the most important. And so we are here today to say that indeed, transit operations, bicycling, and pedestrian needs are very serious needs for the state. There needs to be a statewide solution for them. And there have been conversations going on for years about this, and I'm sure even before the Governor's Vision Committee that led to the big transportation bill in 2009, we've been talking about this. It was discussed that we should move forward. And then there was a committee that was put together last year, the Non-Roadway Transportation Working Group, that I served on, and I think Representative Benson Reed, you followed that as well. And we got to the point where, gosh, we didn't come up with anything that was really a long-term solution, but one of the major pieces that was discussed, and it's on this piece in your testimony, or the attachment to the testimony, was this concept of broadening lottery dollars, you know, a bigger pot for these multimodal needs, and to broaden them for the specific needs that I just mentioned. And the lottery is used for education, it's used for parks, and it's used for economic development. And my testimony talks about, and BTA and others talked about, the fact that when you invest in bicycle and pedestrian projects, you really do get greater jobs per dollar invested than you do in roads alone. And also, if we're going to move freight more efficiently, we need options other than driving alone in your car. And the one study that I would point out in my testimony from the Texas A&M Transportation Institute, they do this every year, and they found in the Portland region, motorists saved an estimated 6.9 million hours in traffic time due to public transit in 2011. If you just snapped your fingers and took public transit away, freight would grind to a halt in the Portland region. So we need these options. We need ability to move folks around in some other way. It's a good investment of transportation dollars. And I think that if you also read my testimony, that I will conclude here. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Representative McEwen.
I just have a clarification. You mentioned pedestrian incidents increasing from 21% to something. 21% of what?
I'm sorry, Chair Reed, Representative McEwen. I was referring to the percentage of injuries, of traffic injuries. 21% of those are pedestrian injuries in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I missed that piece.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. Next up, Dan Eisenbeis, John Mullis, and Donald Leap, please. Thank you for your patience. After you are finished, we have one more person, and I suspect your effectiveness will be correlated with your brevity.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, Dan Eisenbeis with the City of Portland. I will keep my remarks very brief, but do want to go on record offering the City of Portland support for both the Connect Oregon 5 concept, as it's being called, as well as the Connect Oregon Plus concept. And just note that we believe that this does enhance Oregon's competitiveness in a global economy. So with that, thank you for the opportunity to comment. Welcome any questions.
It is indeed brief. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Mullis.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, members of the committee. John Mullis with the Oregon State Building Trades Council here in support of House Bill 2310. We would love to see it funded at $100 million if possible. Our council has always been in support of all the Connect Oregon programs. We're in support of this one not only for the jobs that it would help generate for our members, far too many of whom are out of work, but for the economic development and the job creation that it would help incent all around the state. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Mullis. Mr. Leap.
Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. Donald Leap, I'm the immediate past president of the Association of Oregon Rail and Transit Advocates, AORTA. I am the state representative to the National Association of Railroad Passengers, Sir Arlen's Committee of Delegates, and additionally I serve on the state's Rail Advisory Committee and have been involved with the process of reviewing the applications that were made on the Connect Oregon 3 and Connect Oregon 4 programs so far, and I'm here to support the passage of Bill 2310. This is really very important. Because I've come from a passenger background as opposed to a freight shipper background, there are actually three of us on that committee that are there to represent railroad passengers as opposed to a commodity or something being shipped. The other members are Rob Eaton from Amtrak and Chuck McLaren, who's the past mayor of the city of Milwaukee. These projects work very well, even though they're are obviously largely skewed to freight interests, but there's two, one in Connect Oregon 3 and one in Connect Oregon 4, that have specifically been also to the benefit of our passenger system. When ODOT has gone out a couple of years ago and just this last fall and researched what is important for the rail network and for our Cascades train system in the area, reliability, in other words, if the train leaves on time, the train arrives on time, is the number one thing. That trumps speed, that trumps all other factors. Reliability is number one. And the two projects that also were moved through Connect Oregon 3 and Connect Oregon 4 dealt specifically with that issue. And so this affects not only shippers, but affects the citizens of our great state. And so I sincerely urge you to pass this matter. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Leap. Are there questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Last but certainly not least, J. Michael Moore.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Michael Morrison. I live in Portland, and I'm here representing the Association of Oregon Rail and Transit Advocates, and specifically the portion of the organization that is concerned with active transportation. We're not just concerned with trains and transit services, but active transportation, bicycle and pedestrian facilities. And with that in mind, and this is really the only point that I wish to add to the what Mr. Leap already said, is that Chair Reed has, we thank you very much for your efforts to amend the 2310 to bring bicycle and pedestrian facilities under this measure, and we hope that that succeeds. And we feel that this would be a constructive step forward. I'd just like to point out that the kind of synergy that exists between rail passenger service and bicycle transport can be illustrated with what's happening right now in Oregon City, where the station there, which has Amtrak service twice and soon to be three times a day, will become a bicycle hub, a center for bicycle tourism, where people can come by train and then begin bicycle tours throughout the state of Oregon. And that's an example of the kind of synergy that exists. And with that, I'm going to conclude my remarks. And again, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. And I can answer any question if you wish.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for Mr. Morrison? Representative Cameron.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morrison, a question. Do you envision, for example, once in a while I'll take the train to Portland because we've got businesses up there and enjoy the train, get work done. When I get there, I either have to get on MAX or get a cab to get where I need to go. Do you envision maybe if bikes were included that we would build facilities, like in Washington, D.C. When you go to Washington, D.C., you can find a, I think it's a private company that runs it, but we would help loan them money or something to have these bike rental companies around the cities. And for example, when you get off a train here in Salem, you'd have to be able to put your credit card in and rent a bike. Would that be something that would come under this project?
Chair Reed, Representative Cameron, yes, indeed. I'm glad you brought up that point. I think there's a wonderful opportunity for that. And that's a perfect example of a private-public partnership that would work. That last mile is vital to making transit and rail. You can ride 1,000 miles on a train, but if you can't get that last 2 miles to your final destination, the trip remains incomplete. Your need isn't satisfied. And bikes play a key role in that.
Thank you.
Other questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much for your testimony. That completes the list of people who have signed up. In the few moments that remain, is there anyone else who'd like to testify on House Bill 2310? I don't see anyone. So I just feel compelled to thank everyone for your testimony. As I said at the beginning, I think this is the beginning of a conversation about Connect Oregon. And to anyone who didn't get a chance to testify, if you feel like you have ideas or if any other ideas came to you during the course of the testimony, I would certainly welcome them. I expect other committee members would as well. And I expect that we will return to this concept and to this bill in the near future. So with that, unless there are other comments, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2310. And unless there are any other comments for the good of the order, wish you all a good weekend and see you on Monday. Committee's adjourned.
It's 5 o'clock. Good meeting.
5 minutes.